Meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the RPM sub-team for URS documents taking place on the 31st of July, 2018. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Hearing no names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to Brian Beckham. Please begin.
Okay, thank you, Terry, and welcome again, everyone. I think we'll have to just proceed on the basis of the relatively limited attendance, but then, of course, bear in mind that we are in sub-teams, so that's not completely unexpected that we have fewer people than in the full working group. So just to recap, especially for those of you guys who haven't been part of the document sub-team, what we've been doing last week and what we'll, I guess it's actually the last two calls and what we'll continue to do today with a view to getting together collectively as a full working group tomorrow afternoon, was to go through the URS list of topics document. So we went through that line by line and identified sources of data where documents could help inform the work of other subteams. Since we actually finished the work of this subteam quite quickly, we kind of shifted gears to then start to actually go through the data sources that we identified. And so that brings us really full circle to where we are today, which is our kind of final stab at pulling our look at the document sources together with a view towards very rough preliminary recommendations that we would report up to the full working group tomorrow. And, of course, the other sub-teams are meant to feed into that. And so this is one of the reasons we invited folks who were part of the other sub-teams on last week's call and this week's call, was just to sort of make sure that we're not veering too far off course, or just to make sure that there wasn't anything that we missed. I apologize. I should have asked if anyone had any updates to statements of interest or any questions about the agenda. I suppose those are kind of two standing items. So seeing none, I think we'll proceed on the basis of picking up where we left off last week. So just to kind of, again, recap, we left off on item J, which is language. And I'm keen to kind of get us through the last couple of items, but maybe just to ask before we get to item J, I went through the revised chart that the staff helpfully updated following our last call, and I hope some of you have had a chance to do that. And so what you'll see is in markup there are areas where they've got the word recommendation in all caps, and so they've put down what sort of an idea of what a preliminary recommendation. Of course, this will be discussed tomorrow on the full working group call, but they've put down, so you see, for instance, there just above where we'll start today on J for language, the recommendation with respect to the response fee for 15 plus domain names. That was actually one of the most of them, actually, we were able to pull together some notion of a recommendation, but this was one where we thought this was more appropriate for the full working group to discuss, so, and that could also be a recommendation that finds its way up to the initial report, not so much in terms of a specific recommendation, but a specific call for comments and input from the community on the initial report. So before we get to Jay, I just wanted to ask, I've personally gone through the document and looked at all of the recommendations. I've noted one or two places where we had an open question, but just to see if anyone had any burning thoughts on whether those recommendations were going astray from what you thought we had discussed on the last couple of calls or any of our exchanges over email. Okay, I don't see any, and frankly, I can't imagine there would be any. Like I say, this was all fairly what I would describe as coloring within the lines. So I think with that, we can start with J, the language. And again, for those of you who are either new to us this time or just to recap what we've been doing, Barry's been helping while I would kind of help frame the issue, then Barry, because he's controlling the documents, would flick us over to the document itself that we've identified with a view towards pulling out any possible recommendations. So here we are on J, the language. And so the question was regarding the complaint notice or the response or the determination, so pretty much everything having to do with the URS. And we, of course, had identified all of the different sources of data on this subteam, and from the provider survey, the question is whether they had any experiences, any feedback with respect to their notifications and translations. And I apologize, I don't have the specific requirements committed to heart, but if I remember, there was some sort of a requirement in the URS that the notification document or the communication that captured the notification document would have been translated into the language where it's expected the registrant resides based on the information that comes back from the registrar. So the provider's responses to our question to the survey on the language issue was in pages 18, and I think that's probably, I'm sorry, it's a bit fuzzy on my screen, pages 18 to 20, rows 79 to 84.
Hi, Brian. This is Barry. I'll take over real quick.
So starting on
page 18 of the provider's document, and again, I'll remind you, this may look a little bit small in the Adobe Connect room where the screen sharing pod is located. There is an option in the top right corner of that to expand to full screen. And you can toggle in out should you need to add any comments into the chat, and then you can toggle back into full screen. So hopefully it will be readable to you. So basically, the first question to the providers is: have they experienced any difficulties or issues with the current URS language requirements, and what steps have they taken to comply? This is specifically more or less the question that was submitted from the document subteam. The subsequent rows, I think there's four or five more, actually get into the rules and procedures and those questions. But in general, the first provider, MFSD, I believe, all communications with U.S. parties, registries, and registrars are conducted in English. I'm sorry, it's ADNDRC. They don't have a formal procedure for translating documents or communications to corresponding languages, but the case administrators are usually happy to answer questions from the URS parties. Whereas forum, they check who is information from the registrar, obtain the physical location of the respondent, and based on that information, forum researches what dominant language is in the respondent's physical location in order to provide the translation. Forum does translate all template documents, and if there's a response that comes in from a given region, they'll appoint an examiner that speaks the language of that respondent. All documents are prepared for the examiner in the corresponding language. Many determinations on the forum website are in non-English languages of the respondent. Then MFSD, communications to the respondent, including the notice of complaint, default, and all other emails are translated into the language of the respondent in addition to English. So I believe that this, because of ADNDRC, I believe that this is a summary finding from the provider's subteam that they'll highlight tomorrow. And then in addition, there were a few other questions as it relates to the rules, and I won't read through these in detail, but the first was, you know, do you utilize WHOIS data in order to determine the proper language to be used in transmitting the notice of complaint? Two said yes, one said no. Then they went on, do you think it'd be feasible to mandate sending registry and registrar notices in the same language? I think across the board, it, They don't think that that's feasible, meaning I believe that they probably think that they should all be sent in English. Are all examiners fluent in English? That was yes across the board. Are all assigned examiners fluent in non-English language of the respondents? And ADNDRC said yes. Forum basically says yes when they assign examiners for the language after it's been determined and who is. And each case they assign an examiner fluent both in English and the language notice of the complainant. And I believe that takes care of... Oh, no, then there was one other question. Can you provide any information as to whether and in how many instances it had been demonstrated that a respondent had the capability of understanding English in addition to their primary language? ADNDRC, they based on the respondent's communication records with the providers. Sometimes they also look at evidence submitted by the complainant to determine if a respondent has the capacity to understand English in addition to their primary language. I think Forum still has the action to respond to this particular question, and MFSD basically listed out a number of their complaints where it was English in default, but that there was also translation. So I will turn it back over to you, Brian.
So thanks, Barry, and this is Brian again. Maybe I can try to summarize this, I think, and then see if folks have any comments or questions. I think this section here, the survey results largely fall into two buckets. One is regarding the language of the notification and what that means for the person receiving it, and then the other is the language capabilities of the provider's panelists. With respect to the capabilities of the provider's panelists, of course, they're all, and I think this is actually captured in one of the cells there, that they're meant to be capable of drafting in English, and then, of course, any other languages, that's really down to the provider to determine, you know, based on the needs, if they need a bunch of people that are fluent in Spanish or French or Chinese or whatever, that, of course, would be driven by the volume of cases that they're seeing. So, frankly, I'm not sure what it is we would be looking at in terms of a recommendation on this. This seems to be sort of more of a statement of fact, but certainly welcome other people's views on that. Then the first part of it with respect to the notification of the registrant, I noticed there was a comment in one of the cells from one of the providers about it's not practical or necessary to begin translation work before the information comes back from the registrar, which confirms the authoritative location of the registrant. So before you know who is going to be the registrant, you can't obviously do any translations. And again, you know, just my summary of this is that this is something that's more of a factual observation than something where there's a clear recommendation, obviously complying with the rules, that I think goes without saying that should be done. And if that's not being done, that can form part of a recommendation or a question for follow-up. But I don't want to be the only one kind of driving us through this. So I'm curious if other people see this language section similarly, or if there may be something that I'm overlooking in summarizing that. So I see Petter's put a comment, and then I see Rebecca has her hand raised. So I'll just read Petter's comment, which is what level of knowledge, and I'm assuming that could be of English or another language, is expected as understandable. And that is something that I would imagine there's a reasonable degree of discretion vested with the providers, that they're putting people on their rosters that are fluent in or competent at least in whichever language is necessary. And of course, I think a lot of the rosters of panelists in the URS were drawn from the UDRP, so those are people who would have been fluent in English and in some cases another language. But we can note that comment, Petter. So Rebecca, please.
Rebecca Toshnet. So I just wanted to point out that we have a little bit of indirect evidence that in terms of the review of the decisions. So where the respondent mentioned some issue with language and where the examiner noted that, there are a couple of cases, and there's just a separate sheet in the review. So I wouldn't say that there's evidence of a widespread problem, but it's probably worth noting that we do have, some people have brought it up. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. And I see Petter has his hand up, and I apologize. Would you mind just for my benefit, I apologize, I missed a little bit of that. Was that issues that were raised with the competency of panelists in drafting in English or other languages, or those were issues with respect to the notification side?
So my understanding is, and again, this is second level since we don't have we don't have access to the responses directly. But there are some decisions where the examiner mentions that the respondent says something about like this isn't my language, or there are a couple of cases where the examiner also says, this may not be your main language, but, we think you're competent enough in it based on the other stuff you've submitted.
Okay, thanks, Rebecca. And this is Brian again. Maybe we can note that as something, and I see Mary's put a comment or question in the chat to see if Rebecca is possible to point us to those decisions. I will say that maybe what we want to do is if we could look at those specific decisions and then also to look at the URS rules. I don't know that it's exactly the same, and I know Renee's on the call, so maybe if she happens to know the answer. But at least in the UDRP, there's the possibility for the examiner to decide that the language of proceeding is one that's other than the mother tongue of the registrant, and what often happens, just for whatever it's worth anecdotally in those cases, is the complaint would be filed in one language. Usually it's English. Sometimes it's another major language, and the respondent would reply and say, I'm not capable of defending myself in that language, therefore I demand a translation. And that really is a question that's put to the examiner. And in some cases, they say based on typically it would be prior correspondence between the parties where the respondent is clearly capable of communicating in a language they claim they're not. So you have someone who's trying to kind of delay the proceedings or cause, expense and time of a translation. And the panelists will say, well, look, you've corresponded with this party in the language the complaint's been filed with, and so I'm going to comfortably render the decision in that language. In other cases, the panelists would order a translation. So, again, that's just a long-winded way of saying we probably want to be aware of what the actual URS procedure and rules require and or allow in terms of the panel being vested with some discretion over the ultimate language of proceeding. Please, Petter.
Petter Rinford here. Just to be short, but I don't think this is a problem when it comes to the UDRP, but when it comes to URS, as it's a quick dispute resolution system, there's not so much time for the examiner to reach out to the parties and check out how much they understand of a specific language. So I think it would be good to have some kind of guidelines so that we all can identify in an early stage based on the documentation that has been sent in and the replies if the domain holder actually understandably the language. I've seen many cases where there's a short reply in some kind of very broken English. It's understandable, but you can see that the domain holder definitely not know the language in a normal speakable way. On the other hand, they may provide all documentations in English, so that's enough. But as said, I think it's good if we can create some kind of further guidelines for on this respect. Thanks.
Thank you, Petter. And again, just to, for whatever it's worth, to draw a parallel or an anecdote, of course, this is something that comes up with enough frequency in the UDRP. I wouldn't say it's happens tremendously often, but it has happened enough to where this is something that's discussed in the WIPO overview. So to the extent there's a suggestion to kind of frame some parameters of what examiners would look at, that may be something, if not a starting point, something just to look at in terms of some potential guideposts of what panelists may look at in terms of which fork in the road to take on the language determination issue. And Mary, I just want to read Mary's comment, which is a question to Petter. Petter, whether that suggestion for guidance was meant for respondents or examiners or both.
Petter, if I may. I think it's basically perhaps for the examiners, so that it could be a more strict guideline that is general for this dispute resolution system when we decide upon the language level. But of course, if there are guidelines for the examiners, if they are open, both parties can read and take their conclusions from that guidelines. Thanks.
Absolutely. This is Brian again. Thanks, Petter, for the clarification. I think that's absolutely right. If there's guidance provided publicly for examiners or parties, or vice versa, then the others could certainly look at that. I just wanted to kind of bring us all together on this. I think we have one or two questions on this. David McCauley, I noted earlier in the chat, said that agreed with the kind of broad summary that this was really more of a factual look at things in terms of the language question. And then there was a comment in the chat. I apologize. I don't recall exactly who made it, but this was something that when the full working group gets together, then this might be something that the providers or practitioner subteams have, frankly, more light to shed on this topic for the full working group to consider. So unless people have remaining comments or thoughts or concerns on the language issue, I think we can move to the next bullet, which was, let's see. I'm sort of open question speaking out loud to Mary and Barry. There's a comment on the margins of the next bullet point, which was that the forum provides ICANN with reports of language, need to investigate method and repository of data, and that was not yet started. That was something for us to do. Barry or Mary or anyone, do you mind just refreshing our memory on what those reports were and what there may be for us left to do or consider on that?
This is Barry. It's been in this document for a while. If I recall, this was probably briefly mentioned at the Abu Dhabi meeting, if not San Juan meeting, and because we have Renee on the phone, perhaps she can shed a little bit more light, but honestly, other than what's written here, I'm not very familiar with these reports to ICANN.
Okay, that's fair enough. I think we don't need to spend too much time, and I see Renee's typing something in the chat.
Sorry, I only hung up, of course, and I was trying to take myself off of mute.
Renee, please go ahead.
I can talk a little bit about what we send. I'm trying to pull one up here on my computer screen. Basically, every month we send ICANN a report of how many cases we've had, how many appeals, how many defaults, how many final determinations during that period. And it also includes the languages that were included for that period of time. And I can run it more than monthly. I can run it for the entire duration of what's happened since the URS was adopted. So I can forward an example to the working group if you'd like to see that. But it's mainly statistical. It's not going to give any sort of analysis.
Thanks, Renee. This is Brian. And I think probably, unless people really would like to see that, my guess is that analysis would be covered by Rebecca's research. And I know previously we had on screen looked to be a dozen or more cases where there was a language issue or a potential language issue. So that might be an area where we put as a to-do for this sub-team or for the working group, just to have a look at those specific cases to see if any issues jump out in terms of, potential areas where there was a lack of due process or panelists were kind of erring on the wrong side of taking a particular language determination fork in the road. So that, I think, moves us on. I'm just kind of to summarize the remaining bullets actually in this column here for languages were suggestions from ICANN 61, which we've already covered, and those go, I'm just looking at the last one, for example, where it says how many instances were they at situations where the respondent had the capability of speaking English and understanding English. So this was precisely the idea that I was just mentioning, which was that list of a dozen or so cases where language had been flagged as a potential issue in Rebecca's spreadsheet. It would be good if it's not a volunteer from this sub-team, if we might have someone that would be able to give a look at those just to see if any issues jump out and report back up to, since we're it looks likely that we'll be kind of disbanding the current formulation of sub-teams to report that up to the full working group or a newly convened sub-team that would be tasked with pulling together some preliminary recommendations for the full working group. So we'll put that as a to-do, and I see Mary's put in a comment that staff can do that. So thank you, Mary. That's very helpful. We'll keep an eye out for that. So the next item is K, abuse of process. So again, for the document sub-team, we frankly wondered, and again, I would invite people who have been involved in the sub-team, and this would be some of our first chats when Jay Scott was still with us. We wondered what data collection would be pointing us to questions about potential abuse of process, and this was something where we thought we may need to revisit this question based on the different reviews of the respondent prevailed cases. So we had the responses from the provider questionnaire on page 27, and that's rows 122 to 126. So as Barry's pulling us up there, I will pull out my hard copy as well. So 122 to 126 columns. So that's all there at the kind of bottom half of page 27. So Barry, would you mind just kind of walking us through the high level of those 122 to 127?
Thank you, Brian. Barry Cobb for the record. So yeah, as noted, since the doc subteam didn't pass this any specific question along to the providers, that's why you'll note that there's not one listed here. So all of the five rows are specifically connected to provisions listed within the rules or the procedures document. In short, they asked, how have you complied with the obligation to establish and maintain a process to monitor URS abuse? Are you coordinating the listing of abusive complaints with other providers? And how do you and other providers share information about abusive complaints? Basically, ADN DRC reminds its examiners of the existence of abuses complaints. They don't have a mechanism that will automatically flag them upon determination of abusive complaints. The four ADN DRC offices responsible for publishing the decision will notify the other three offices as a result. Forum came back, and if the examiner finds the complainant abusive, they'll electronically flag it for Forum. Staff will be notified immediately. They will review the determination and inform other providers and the decision to abusive findings database shared by the providers. It's also available on Forum's website and found by clicking the box entitled URS Findings of Abuse. Forum hosts the combined abusive complaint database. Each provider has login information, and only the provider that adds information is able to edit any of that information, and they can't go back in and take somebody out, basically. The system is developed to inform all the providers. MFSB, pretty much kind of the same response as the other two. Also note, then on row 124, have the examiners found any abusive complaints? All three were none. Forum did note that one was submitted in early 2016, but it was added in error and removed. And the next question, have you imposed any penalty for abusive complaint? If so, what is it? All three had stated no. And then the last question is, do you, as a standard procedure, verify the eligibility of the complaint against the abuse case database for every URS case? Providers were checked, but there's nothing to check at present because there are no complaints submitted into the system. I'll turn it back to you, Brian.
Thank you, Barry. And so I that's a very useful summary, and I think it's useful to see that this is a case of the data showing, at least so far, no instances of abuse being found by an examiner, notwithstanding, I know Mary made a comment in the chat that that there were 20 cases where the respondent had requested that finding, but none where the examiner actually found it. And then the one where the forum had marked that was actually an error that was corrected, so that there were no abusive complaints, at least in terms of the way it would have been expected to be recorded by the examiner, having been recorded so far. And again, I think it's useful to note this is from rows 122 and 123, that I'm guessing from the way these answers are phrased that there's a requirement in the URS itself that the providers kind of communicate with each other in terms of any finding of abusive complaints, and it looks like they're doing that as a kind of a matter of course, and then that also flows to the screening of intake of complaints just to make sure that there weren't any abusive complaints in the past that were being filed again by the same party. And if I recall, there was sort of a three strikes rule in the URS that would bar abusive complaints from filing. I believe it may have been for 1 year initially, and then if there were further abuses, they may have been barred altogether. So again, I think here it's a case of the data shows that there haven't been abuses, at least in terms of how that's expressed in the URS and how examiners are supposed to look at that. And again, we'll look at what the providers and practitioners, tell us about this topic tomorrow when we all get together. But just while there are a few of you here in the room that I know have been either representing complainants or respondents or are even examiners in the URS, is there anything that anyone on the call might be able to share in something that they've felt would kind of cross this line of abusive complaints, even if it weren't recorded as such by an examiner in the determination? Okay, I don't see any. By all means, if anyone on the call later thinks of an instance where they thought there maybe it would have been appropriate to record an abuse, or maybe Rebecca from your research, if there seems to be something where, and again, this can kind of get into subjective territory, but if people felt that that circumstances warranted a finding of abuse but weren't, then certainly that's something that the working group would want to look at. So again, I think this is an area where we'll certainly look to the other sub-teams to help inform the full working group, but for present purposes, it sounds like we can move on from item K, the abuse of process item, unless I don't see any comments or hands up, unless, and of course we can come back to this, but it looks like we can move on to item I, which is education and training. So I just to make sure it's in the record, David McCauley made a comment in the chat that just to kind of affirm the point I was making was that a respondent may make that claim, and that might be in the decision, but it might not be recorded as a specific finding by the examiner, but it might be in the language of the determination itself. That would obviously be something that would need to come out of a more thorough review of the actual determination. In terms of education and training, one of the areas that this subgroup looked at initially was what was on the provider's websites in terms of training or education, and this could be to examiners, this could be to filing parties, it could even go to registries or registrars to the extent that involved issues around communicating with them or implementing decisions. We had a brief exchange, and I'm going to hope that Barry or Mary or someone that could kind of help refresh my memory, but we did look at, and I know we have some of the responses from the provider's survey that we can look at, but from reviewing the websites, I think most of the information, if I recall, was not so much by way of specific quote-unquote education that you would think of in terms of a how-to or an FAQ guide for filing parties, but was more along the lines of model pleading, so a model complaint, a model response, things of that nature. So maybe we can move over to the provider questions on page 22, row 96, if you don't mind, Barry. So this is the question of sorry, go ahead, Barry.
I was just going to go ahead and this section was based off, again, the rules document. What they ask for the providers is, what guidance have you formally or informally given to examiners? With a follow-up question is, what are your understanding of the guidelines referred to in URS Rule 13C? Are they referring to provider supplemental rules? If not, can you provide a copy of any alternative guidelines that you have developed? There's quite a bit to read through here. But Forum, they do have a template for determinations through its portal. There are text boxes that are required to be filled out for the reasoning, and determinations are issued upon completion to the parties and are available on the website immediately. All decisions on the website can be full text search. MFSD stated that determinations are filed by the examiner through his or her account. At the online dispute management platform, examiners are provided with instructions on URS elements and defenses and how to conduct the examination of URS proceeding. References to URS procedures and rules are contained in online documentation. Determinations shall meet the requirements of paragraphs 8 and 9 of URS procedure and 13 and 15 of the URS rules. Determination is transmitted to the registry with the specification of the remedy and the required actions to be taken, and then published on their website afterwards. They also point to some supplemental rules about examiner decisions. And I believe pretty much ADNDRC follows the same procedure more or less, and they also point to their own supplemental rules, Article 9 examiner determinations, that I believe provides more guidance. I think there's a little too much to read here. So I'll turn it back to you, Brian.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. And while you were walking us through that, I did go and look through my emails, and in fact, it was exactly as I had recalled, which was the information we found on the provider's website was the model pleadings, which included the complaint, the response, the appeals. So there was that was what was on the provider's website in terms of education for potential filing parties. We then had on the same survey response form from the providers, we had rows 58 to 77, which actually takes us from page 14 down to page 17, so quite a lot to go through. Maybe if Barry, if you want to kind of walk us through that, I would just say my kind of quick summary of that, and Renee certainly would be helpful if you could help just kind of confirm if this is right, was that most of the URS examiners were experienced somehow, if not in the UDRP and in internet domain name law generally, and that those examiners were drawn from a list of people who had previous experience, and then some of the providers had different either in-person or kind of webinar-type training available for the panelists. But Barry, please, on page 14, row 58.
Thank you, Brian. Barry Cobb for the record. I think what I'll just do is just read through the questions proposed to the providers, and then, you know, this group and the full working group can read through the details. But in short, they basically asked, you know, how do you select the examiners and that their backgrounds comport with the URS rule and procedures? Then they also asked, what, if any, training or guidance do you provide for the selected examiners? Thirdly, they asked, you know, what factors should we consider in regard to evaluating your processes and practices pertaining to examiner's selection and training? Then they also asked, have you maintained and made publicly available a list of your selected URS examiners and their qualifications? All three of those responses were saying that those were publicly available. There's a question to ADNDRC informed specifically asking why the qualifications of some of your examiners had not been published, but I believe that there were proper responses that that they are now. And then based on Rule 6B, what is your conflict of interest policy for examiners, and how do you make up the examiners aware of their obligation to be impartial and independent? And then last or next two questions, how do your examiners confirm their impartiality and independence? And then follow-up is to provide a copy of an oath taken by your examiners to affirm that they will be neutral and independent. And is the oath signed by the examiners? So a fair amount of information there. I think it looks like the providers did a great job in responding with substantive information about how the examiners are trained and some of the guidelines that they're to follow. I'll turn it back to you, Brian.
Thanks, Barry. And before I weigh in, Mary, you had your hand up.
I did. Thanks, Brian and Barry. Excuse me. Apologies for my voice. I'm still a little under the weather. But I just wanted to try to follow up on Barry's going through these columns and note that the providers do have some follow-up that went through the provider sub-team that is following up with the various providers. Barry's noticed some of it. One of this is in relation to looking at notice of complaint. But in addition to the specific points that Barry has mentioned, one potential recommendation that seems to be emerging from the provider sub-team is whether or not some kind of multilingual basic FAQ should be developed for both complainants and respondents. And another question that's arisen is whether in respect of each of their supplemental rules and specific processes, whether the providers should be developing some additional educational materials. So I just thought that I should highlight these two potential recommendations as well as the ongoing work in the provider sub-team. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, Mary, and absolutely this is an area where we'll look to the other sub-teams, I think, largely for guidance here. I would say, for whatever it's worth, my kind of very high-level summary of the responses from the providers to the questions that Barry walked us through was that this all seemed to be fairly routine. In other words, the providers had drawn their examiners from lists of existing examiners, maybe from UDRP or elsewhere, that they had undertaken some training, that they rely on them to submit a declaration of independence in the cases. There didn't seem to be any issues where that had arisen. And then, of course, they had some questions about the rotation and the volume of the list, that sort of thing. But all of this seemed to be rather routine or vested with the provider in terms of managing, its roster based on its language needs or its case volume needs and the declaration of independence and impartiality in each case. I just want to read, David McCauley put a comment in the chat about a multi-language FAQ may make sense. David, just for my benefit, can you kind of help explain what the FAQ would be geared towards? Is that something having to do with examiner conflicts?
Hello, Brian. David McCauley speaking, for the record. In my view, this is my personal view, an FAQ that was aimed at complainants, at respondents, and examiners would make sense. Just to sort of restate or to explain some of the rules and procedures and to be based on experience. So I just think it's a good idea is generally what I'm saying. I think it would be a good idea, the fact that it's multi-language, the fact that it's going to cover some certain basic fundamentals that these folks need to be apprised of. My review of the de novo cases that we spoke about last week led me to believe that not even all examiners are as conversant with some of the things that would be covered in an FAQ, and so an FAQ would be helpful for them, perhaps. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, David, and this is Brian again. And I note Mary had made a comment in the chat, which was that the section we're on here, education and training, actually overlaps to a substantial degree with the next section, which is the URS providers. That's row M in the document, and we had in the same document on page 29 on row 136, there was a question which related to the providers. And this question, while Barry's pulling it up, I can just kind of walk us through the question, which was relating to the providers and their review of the supplemental rules. And the answers from the providers were basically that they had reviewed their rules and didn't see a need to produce further updates to those. So I think with that answer from the providers and with the understanding from the prior section on education and training, again, that a lot of this will actually look to the provider sub-team and maybe to a lesser degree to the practitioner sub-team. I think that takes us through these items, I and M, the education and training and the URS providers. I don't see any additional comments or hands being raised. That takes us to N, which was alternative processes. This was something I'm not sure what this was exactly supposed to cover. We have in the second full column there, we have a question about whether there should be some kind of alternative to the URS. Of course, bear in mind that the URS was meant to already be an alternative to the UDRP. And then there was a suggestion for mediation. So this was something where in the document subteam, we didn't really identify any particular sources. This might be something which, frankly, was more in the area of you know, some academic research that would look to compare different dispute resolution systems, maybe across CCTLDs and top-level domains, so maybe looking at the Nominet system versus DDRP or other countries. For example, Germany under the DE regime, they actually don't have a dispute resolution system. They leave it to people to go to court. That's something that's raised not infrequently from potential filing parties towards us. I just see a comment from Mary in the chat that this section was added simply from suggestions somewhere along the way from members of the working group, and this wasn't actually in the charter. So I don't think we need to really spend too much time on this. It's something that maybe is a bit more in the realm of the academic. I would just note that it actually is a comment from me there in the margin that to the extent we do look at this, that we really look at the full picture. I know a lot of times people refer to the Nominet system, and it seems to work very well for the .UK namespace. But one of the major differences, of course, the Nominet system has mediation, and they have a full and a summary determination, and they have an appeals process. But the registry actually subsidizes that process. There are filing fees. They tend to be a bit lower than what you have in the URS, but this is something that you know, when we as a working group are making policy recommendations, it's important to kind of zoom out and see the bigger picture, which is if we, for example, were to recommend all of the aspects that are available in the Nominet system, it would be important to bear in mind what are the kind of financial repercussions, whether that's on registries and registrars, on filing parties, on responding parties. So just to kind of have an eyes wide open view of that question. So maybe before we move on to what are the next steps for this subteam, for the full working group, we have, of course, a full working group call tomorrow, just to see if there were any questions, any comments, any concerns from people on the call, anything you think we may have missed, something that we need to go through in more depth, or whether we look to the update that we hope to get from the staff before tomorrow's call that we would report up as a subteam to the full working group for our call tomorrow. So this would be, the idea is to take what we had in the section of the document prior to what we started today, where we had the additional text, where we had the word recommendation in full caps and then a proposed recommendation, from this subteam up to the full working group. The idea was to basically continue that methodology through what we've covered today. We'll, of course, circulate that across the subteam and make sure there's nothing that's been missed, and then report that up tomorrow to the full working group, and then collectively see where we go from there. Are there any questions about what we've done today? Any questions about the next steps for this working group, subteam, sorry? Any questions about the call that we have tomorrow? I think if there are none, I don't see any comments or any hands being raised. No one would be too upset if we finished early, of course, given that we have a call tomorrow. So we can collectively keep our eyes out for the update to this document, and really encourage everyone to participate tomorrow and then in the calls across the month of August, because this is really where we're hoping to try to pull together the work that we've been doing now for over 2 years. Not, of course, all of that has been geared towards the URS, but we've been at this for a while, and I think it would be good for all of us to start to see some of this come together by way of draft recommendations or ideas where we need further comments from the community in our initial report. So I don't see any hands. I don't see any comments. I think unless we hear from somebody imminently, we'll leave it at that. I think we have a game plan for this subteam. We have a game plan for our full working group tomorrow. And thanks, everyone, and we'll see you all tomorrow, hopefully. So, Terry, I think we can end the call, and thanks again, everyone.
Thank you very much, Brian. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you, everyone, for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.